So it was a big deal, and it was one of the three biggest strikes in labor history.
And that's Mike Ferner, an activist, organizer, and former member of the Toledo City Council. On today's show, Mike discusses organizing a public event with the Toledo Area Solidarity Committee commemorating the anniversary of the 1934 Autolite Strike. Now, if you haven't heard about the Autolite Strike, which started 90 years ago on April 12, 1934, this will be a great introduction to that historic strike. But what made Mike's discussion especially interesting to me is that it took place in 2021, 37 years after the commemoration he helped organize. It's a great example of the importance of getting these stories recorded while folks are still around to tell them. So here's a shout-out to Sean Nestor, who conducted the interview, and to Cullen Park Productions, which did the videography. We've got a link to the YouTube interview in the show notes.
You know, we're talking about taking down these statues, and should they take them down or should they not take them down? But what about in our own house?
The AFL-CIO last year renamed the Gompers Room the Solidarity Room. Coalition of Black Trade Unionists President Terry Melvin tells us why. And on Labor History in 2...
The year was 1919. Labor leader and socialist Eugene V. Debs was sent to prison for speaking out against World War I.
I'm Chris Garlock, and this is Labor History Today. Before we get to Mike Ferner and the 1984 commemoration, here's Rick Smith with an overview of the 1934 Autolite Strike.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day that workers at the Toledo Autolite factory decided to go on strike. The company made electric starters for the auto giants in nearby Detroit. The punishing effects of the Great Depression had hit the auto industry hard. Unemployment in the industrial city of Toledo soared. At the Autolite plant, workers faced increased scrutiny from their bosses, who knew hundreds of eager-to-work laborers stood at the ready just outside the plant's gate, ready to take the job of anyone who dared to complain. Philip Croth and Margaret Beagle recalled the working conditions in an oral history of the strike, saying, "Under observation, even into the toilets, workers found themselves sneaking a bite to eat or a puff of a cigarette, aware that they would be fired if discovered." One of the most hated practices by management was known as the bench. Workers were told to sit on a bench where they would wait until they were needed to perform a job. Once that job ended, they went back to the bench, being paid for only the time spent while working. Faced with such conditions, the workers had had enough and went out on strike. The company won an injunction that allowed only 25 workers to picket at any one location. But then something happened that the company had not expected. The Lucas County Unemployment League stood up with the picketers. Instead of taking the jobs of those on strike, the unemployed members of the league rallied to the picket lines in defiance of the injunction. In late May, picketers and the National Guard clashed in what became known as the Battle of Toledo. Finally, on June 2nd, the strike was settled. The workers had won a 5% raise and union recognition. Today's Labor History in 2 brought to you in memory of Carol Hillman, a passionate friend of workers and volunteer of the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Mike Ferner is an activist, organizer, and a former member of the Toledo City Council. Over a career that spanned decades, he's earned a reputation for his work on a variety of environmental, peace, and labor issues. In this next segment, Mike discusses organizing a public event with the Toledo Area Solidarity Committee commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Autolite Strike. The 1984 event was well attended, but United Auto Workers leadership at the time discouraged its members from attending.
One of the things the Solidarity Committee did in 1984 was the 50th anniversary of the historic Autolite strike in Toledo. and that the strike happened in 34, which was the year before the UAW was formed. So it wasn't really a UAW strike, but it was at an auto parts plant and has been associated with the UAW. So those of us that were active labor supporters, we thought, well, you know, geez, we got to do something to mark the anniversary of the strike, because the strike was won. The workers got a contract, they got a raise, and then some of the organizers who won that strike went on to go to Flint, Michigan, to help organize the Flint sit-down strike, and to other places to organize what became the United Auto Workers. So it was a big deal. And it was one of the three biggest strikes in labor history in 34. There were a couple of general strikes in San Francisco and I think Minneapolis, and the Toledo strike, which wasn't a general strike, but it's often ranked in there with as important as the other ones. So anyway, we wanted to do something to mark the 50th anniversary, and it didn't look like the UAW was going to do anything public. Turned out they wound up doing something at the Union Hall, but they weren't going to do a public thing. So the Solidarity Committee decided we were going to do that. And we wanted to work with the UAW, but we were getting the feeling from the leadership that they just weren't interested in working with us on that. And come to find out, it was more than just kind of not being interested. But they put the word out to the UAW members in the area to not attend the rally at the courthouse on the day that it was held, because it was organized by communists. And those of us in the Solidarity Committee had a good laugh at that, because the way the Autolite strike was won was by the communist organized unemployed league. A.J. Musty was one of the main organizers of that, and came to Toledo and organized, and this is in 1934, organized unemployed people to go out on the picket line with the workers who were striking. And usually, you know, those are the first people that are going to wind up being scabs, because they don't have a job. But here it was, the depth of the Depression, the unemployed people, because they were organized by people who had an ideology that was, you know, 100% working class, they wound up going out and not just kind of being there, but actually turned that around. So that strike, which was going south on the Union, became a victory because of the intervention of the Unemployed League. They would bring masses of people, thousands of people, out to the picket line. They'd be arrested by the hundreds. They'd overflow the jail. They had to let them out. They'd go back down to the picket line. I mean, I talked to some of the people who were involved in that, and it was an amazing operation. And anyway, so that strike was won. We had 800 people, which for Toledo is a pretty big deal for a rally. We had 800 people show up at the courthouse. And I think it was in June or May of 1984, which was the 50th anniversary. So we were real happy with that.
Well, and so they smeared you guys as communists. Were there any active communists, including yourself, in the, were you identifying as a communist in 1984?
No, I never joined anybody's party.
Now, you were just too left, so the smear, and still with the Cold War, was that, oh, he's a communist.
Yeah, in those days, you know, it was still a good way to smear somebody. I think a year or two before that was the AP Parts strike. I mentioned the Solidarity Committee was active in that. We built a strike shack and drove it out there to the picket line because it was in the cold weather and they had some shelter. And we had, in fact, Sue lettered it. It was a plank about 6 feet wide, and it just said Toledo Area Solidarity Committee, and Sue lettered it. And one of the UAW staff members came by and said, "Get that sign off of there. That's a bunch of communists." So, you know, the guys on the picket line, they were happy to have the strike shack, but, you know, whatever. So, you know, the sign came down. And then another day, it was at night. I'm standing over there around the burn barrel, you know, I got my AFSCME jacket on, and we're just shooting the shit and talking about unions and strikes. And this car pulls up, slams on the brakes, pulls over and says, "Get your fucking ass off this picket line or I'm going to kick it off." And it was his name was Rod Smith. And he was a staff rep for the UAW. And these two guys that were there at the burn barrel with me are looking like, "Well, what the hell's going on?" So, you know, I left, but, you know, then when I mentioned earlier that when I first ran for city council in 87, one of the endorsements I got was from the Police Patrolmen's Association, from the police. So I was okay for the cops, but I was too red for the UAW, which has been something that's always kind of tickled me.
Mike Ferner talking to Sean Nestor about the 1984 commemoration of the historic 1934 Toledo Auto Light Strike. We've got a link to the YouTube interview in the show notes. You're listening to Labor History Today.
You know, we're talking about taking down these statues and should they take them down or should they not take them down? But what about in our own house?
That's Terry Melvin, president of CBTU, the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. Last year, the AFL-CIO changed the name of its main meeting room from the Gompers Room to the Solidarity Room. Terry tells us why. Plus, he shares his favorite labor song.
I thought we would just start out with when we last saw you was at the AFL-CIO Executive Council, and it was in the Solidarity Room, which has not always been the Solidarity Room.
Correct.
So I thought maybe you could tell the story of what it used to be and why it is now the Solidarity Room.
So what happened was forever, as long as I can remember, I should say, the Solidarity Room was named the Gompers Room. And I didn't really pay it any attention. Samuel Gompers was a labor leader from years ago, and he started the AFL, and, you know, it's a great thing, I guess. They named a room after him. And it wasn't until, you know, we started going through we started the Racial Justice Task Force. And on the Racial Justice Task Force, I am the executive director, and Alvina Yeh was a member of the task force, and she was from Apollo. And as we were going through talking about all these issues and the issues affecting workers of color, Black folks and workers of color in the movement and outside of the movement, we had several meetings, and then she brought up the issue of the other thing was the issue of statues being taken down in the South and the struggle with that and what's going on with that. And one of the things about the Racial Justice Task Force is that we had decided that we need to look internally at our movement before we can tell people on the outside what they should be doing. How novel an idea, right? So as we were having a conversation, both at the Racial Justice Task Force meeting and at the Progressive Workers Coalition meetings that we were having, Alvina brought up the issue that, look, you know, we're talking about taking down these statues and should they take them down or should they not take them down? But what about in our own house? You know, we've got this big room that everybody uses downstairs, and it's called the Gompers Room, and it's named after a man that was against people of Asian descent. I mean, he actually fought against people of Asian descent coming to the country. And how can we, you know, he had the Chinese Exclusion Act that he was fighting for back in the day. And oh, yeah. And so it's like, how can we have a room that the biggest room in the place that people come to use, and it's by a racist, right? So we took that both. I had the conversation with Fred Redman, and I had the conversation with Liz Shuler at two different times. But before I could get to Liz, Fred had already talked to her, and she hadn't even thought about it either until it was brought to her attention. And she immediately put together a work group to look at not just the Gompers Room, but to look at all the rooms and see who we had rooms named after in the building, right? So the Gompers room definitely stood out as the one that had the biggest impact on us as a movement when we are trying to be all things to all people. And the committee recommended that we change the name from the Gompers room to the Solidarity room. And then the other thing that the committee recommended and the president had approved, which we have not got to yet, is while we name the room the Solidarity Room, what we're supposed to do is have Solidarity Room all over the room in the different languages. That's part two, right? And we haven't got to that part yet, but that's part of it also. It's not just called the Solidarity Room, but it's supposed to be seen as the Solidarity Room also. So we're going to be working on that part. But I mean, this is a testament to not just the work of the Racial Justice Task Force, which of course I'm very proud of, the work that we've been able to do, but the leadership of Liz Shuler and Fred Redman on these issues of import to all of our members, and to make sure that our movement is welcoming to everybody. So I give kudos to them for giving us the space to really lift up these issues and to follow through on issues that are brought to their table.
I'd like you to reflect a little, if you would, wearing your CBTU hat, and also referring back to Black Lives Matter and where that's at now in terms of why these symbols matter, whether it's a statue that people want to take down or renaming a room, because I think some people want to say, well, you know, it's a name of a room. Who cares?
Well, I think it's reflective of if I am of Asian descent, and I'm walking into a room named after somebody that I knew literally hated me and my culture, right? I'm not going to feel comfortable in that space. If I'm an African-American person and I'm living in a city that has statues, well, first of all, I've never understood how losers get statues all around this country. I don't know. They lost the war. I mean, they lost. So how did they get statues? But even taking it further than that, if I'm a Black person and I got to go up to this statue with this person that was trying to keep me enslaved in this country and was trying to break the country apart to keep me enslaved, I got a problem with that as a Black person, right? So you can't say that you're being inclusive and you understand who I am and what I represent if you want to keep this statue of this loser who was trying to take away my rights, not give me any rights of my ancestors when I was coming up. So yeah, they definitely have an impact on the psyche of those of us who have been oppressed and our ancestors have been oppressed by what these statues represent. So it's not just a statue, but it's what it really represents. And for people who want to keep the statue and talk about it as a part of history, well, that's the ugliest part of history of this country. And for us to say that we want to lift up our ugliness, that is crazy to me. That's absolutely crazy.
So, as you will recall, my brother, that on April 3rd, and that rainy night, Martin Luther King gave the Bend to the Mountaintop speech, right? And that there are those who, aside from all the other things that were said about what King was doing that put a target on his back, was part of one of them was also going, he said, first of all, he's at a union rally.
The garbage workers.
And for the garbage workers, in terms of looking at that time and where we are now, in terms of coalition of Black trade unionists, and in terms of the African-Americans and the labor movement and racism in this country, what's your analysis? What did we learn from those lessons we can apply today?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we have come at least a long way. I mean, I can remember coming up in the movement when I was the only Black person and the youngest person in the room where decisions were being made, right? And it was because I was blessed to have union leadership within my own union, CSEA Local 1000, AFSCME, that were not afraid of bringing up this young Black kid that had a big mouth and wouldn't shut up. And I had five elderly Black women in the movement that kept me on track, right? And made sure that I knew what I needed to know, that I was where I needed to be, that nobody, you know, put roadblocks up for me. So that was a blessing for me, but I looked around and seen so many spaces that could be filled with people of color. And now, you know, a few decades later, now I see my international union that has a Black president. I see a CWA with a Black president. I see AFGE with a Black president. I see the biggest union that even that's not even a part of the AFL, NEA, with a Black. I mean, so we have so many Black leaders at the top of the movement now, and in second spots in secretary treasurer positions that. And at the AFL with Fred Redmond in the number two spot, that has a lens, a racial lens at the things that we are looking at within the movement. We can't help to, but to bring all of who we are to whatever positions we have in this movement. So now, before we would have to say, how do we get the message that, that Black people need X to our president? Or how do we get this? Now our president is one who in many cases have been through what we've been through, who've walked through the racist doors early on in the labor movement and in society and had to learn to live with that struggle. So we have come a long way, but we have not yet attained, right? We have, there's still a long way to go. We have still got many unions, and you see it just like I do, at least at the AFL-CIO Executive Council meeting. It's still not as dark, and it's still not as enough estrogen in the room to really reflect the real demographics of our movement. So that is where CBTU is on these issues, as well as, I would say, the other constituency groups. We are going to continue to be the conscience of the labor movement. We are going to continue to make sure the issues of Black workers, of brown workers, of women workers, of LGBTQ workers, of Hispanic workers, of Asian workers is on the table and are discussed and are addressed, because and it's a selfish reason for us, but it's selfish also for the labor movement. Look, we know and we've seen the demographics of those that want to come into this movement are young, Black, and brown, and women, right? So if those are the people coming into the movement, either the movement is going to get themselves ready, or these folks are just going to come in and do like young folks do anyway. They're going to come in and take over and make this union movement something different than we even thought it could be. So we're either going to meet them where they are and help bring them in, or they're going to drag us somewhere else.
Do you have a favorite labor song and why? Which was your favorite? I mean, not your all time, but what's one off the top of your head?
Solidarity Forever. Because I truly believe that if we have true solidarity, we can go great places and do great things. But as long as we're separated, we're not going to move.
When I look at you, I look into the eyes of the ancestors. The people who worked in the fields or the mines or the factories, the works in the homes of others, the ones who sweated day and night without weekends or sick days or holidays. We are the survivors, and we have work to be done. Because in our hands is placed a power greater than their hoarded gold. Greater than the might of armies magnified a thousandfold. We will bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old. You can join hands. For the union makes us strong. And that's why we sing Solidarity Forever.
Solidarity forever, solidarity forever for the union makes us strong. Go in peace, go in love, go in solidarity.
That was Elise Bryant at the AFGE Women's Fair Practices Luncheon at the 2015 Grassroots and Mobilization Legislative Conference. Before that, Terry Melvin, president of CBTU, the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, on changing the name of the AFL-CIO's Gompers Room to the Solidarity Room. That segment previously aired on the Labor Heritage Power Hour, which airs Thursdays at 1 p.m. on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. You can catch the podcast on your favorite podcast app. Just search for Labor Heritage Power Hour.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1919. Labor leader and socialist Eugene V. Debs was sent to prison for speaking out against World War I. Debs was a well-known figure. In 1894, he had led the American Railway Union out on a strike against the Pullman Railway Car Company. A quarter of a million railway workers walked off the job in support of the strike until it was brutally crushed by the United States military. Debs was arrested and served time in prison for his role in the strike. Due to his popularity, government officials were alarmed by Debs' pacifist stance. So, in 1917, when he gave a speech against World War I in Canton, Ohio, he was arrested under the Espionage Act. The act had been passed a few months prior, making it illegal to interfere with the armed services' recruitment efforts during wartime. At his trial at a federal court in Cleveland, Ohio, Debs defended himself. In his final statement, he explained his motivation. "I am thinking this morning of the men in the mills and the factories, of the men in the mines and on the railroads. I am thinking of the women who, for a paltry wage, are compelled to work out their barren lives, of the little children who, in this system, are robbed of their childhood." He was found guilty, and so, on this date, he started his 10-year sentence. In Cleveland, infuriated unionists and socialists led a protest of Debs' imprisonment. Violence broke out during the march. Mounted police and even tanks were brought in to suppress the demonstrators. In the aftermath, two people were killed, more were injured, and dozens were arrested. While in prison, Debs ran for president of the United States on the socialist ticket, receiving nearly 1 million votes. Finally, in 1921, President Harding commuted Debs' sentence to time served. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
And that's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app. Even better, if you like what you hear, and we sure hope you do, like it in your podcast app, pass it along, and leave a review. That really helps folks to find the show. Labor History in Two is a partnership between the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. That's a labor-themed radio show out of Pennsylvania. Labor History Today is produced by the Labor Heritage Foundation and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. You can keep up with all the latest labor arts news. Subscribe to LHF's weekly newsletter at laborheritage.org. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Evan Papp, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdak. By the way, along with a bunch of the folks I just mentioned, I'll be at the Labor Notes Conference coming up next week in Chicago, where we'll also be holding the Labor Heritage Foundation's Great Labor Arts Exchange. If you're there, look for us at the LHF or Labor Radio Podcast Network tables, and you can also check out our daily reports on the Labor Radio Podcast weekly feed. Plus, LHF will be streaming selected sessions on the LHF Facebook page. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Scarlock. Thanks for listening, keep making history, and see you next time.